KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
A Michigan attorney who counts a pro-Palestinian protester among his clients says he was detained and asked to hand over his phone during questioning at the Detroit airport.
We speak with him about the encounter with federal border agents.
For Wednesday, April 9th, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Many schools teach kids to memorize 8 major planets.
But some astronomers suspect that there's another one out there. They call it Planet 9.
This is the 5th largest planet in our solar system, lurking out there, waiting to be found.
Later, how the medical drama The Pit portrays a neurodivergent character.
We speak with Taylor Dearden, who plays second-year resident Dr. Mel King.
I relate to this character because I see a lot of the neurodivergent parts of Mel is something I experience all the time.
All those stories and more after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Global markets shuddered, and it appears the Trump administration blinked. U.S. stocks soared today after the administration said it would temporarily back off on steep reciprocal tariffs for 90 days for most countries. Stocks were moving into bear market territory, and a bond sell-off was underway, but Trump had a different explanation for his decision.
You have to have flexibility. I could say, here's a wall, and I'm going to go through that wall. I'm going to go through it no matter what. Keep going and you can't go through the wall. Sometimes you have to be able to go under the wall, around the wall, or over the wall.
The administration is keeping auto tariffs in place, as well as 25% tariffs on some goods from Canada and Mexico. The two countries would not be subject to the 10% tariff on goods that will be in effect for others. The one major exception to all this, China, where Trump has now raised tariffs to 125% after Beijing retaliated with tariffs of its own. The Trump administration is tapping Secretary of the Army Dan Driscoll as the new acting head of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Driscoll replaces the ATF's previous interim boss, FBI Director Kash Patel. Here's NPR's Ryan Lucas.
Dan Driscoll was confirmed by the Senate as Secretary of the Army on a bipartisan basis. Now he's been tapped to serve as acting ATF Director as well. He will continue to serve as Army Secretary in addition to ATF Acting Director. It's the same sort of unusual dual-hatted arrangement that the previous acting boss had, FBI Director Kash Patel. No reason was given for the leadership shakeup. The ATF has around 5,000 employees, about half of whom are special agents. It is the main agency responsible for enforcing federal gun laws, and it plays a critical role working with state and local law enforcement to solve gun crimes. The ATF also regulates the firearms industry. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Health officials in Gaza say Israeli airstrikes on Gaza City have killed at least 23 people, most women and children. The Israeli military says it was targeting the senior Hamas figure responsible for planning attacks, but gave few details. NPR's Anas Baba reports from Gaza.
The airstrikes hit a densely packed neighborhood in eastern Gaza City. More than 60 people were wounded, many of them critically. Rami Dababish with the Civil Defense spoke to NPR as his team tried to reach a 7-year-old boy trapped under rubble next to his dead parents and 3 siblings. Here, the rescue operators tried to dig the family out with their bare hands. The boy is eventually reached, but he's already dead. The airstrikes turned to rubble the entire multi-story apartment building and damaged homes around it. 2 other buildings nearby were also struck. Israel's military says its air force bombed more than 45 targets across Gaza in the past 24 hours. Anas Baba, NPR News, Gaza City.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington. A federal appeals court has now given the Trump administration permission to fire thousands of probationary workers, holding a judge's order requiring they be reinstated. A split panel for the 5th U.S. Circuit ruling today, the government will probably win by showing the mass firings must be appealed through a separate employment process. The decision in a case filed in Maryland comes a day after the Supreme Court blocked a similar order from a California judge. Atlanta-based Delta Airlines says President Trump's tariffs are weighing on the travel sector. For member station WABE, Marlon Hyde reports Delta released its first earnings report of the year.
Delta says domestic consumer and corporate travel are taking the biggest blows from Trump's tariffs. Company officials say they will defer any deliveries facing an import tax. CEO Ed Bastian.
Coming into 2025, we are positioned for another year of strong growth. However, Given broad economic uncertainty around global trade, growth has largely stalled.
The company brought in revenue of $13 billion this quarter, more than 3% higher than last year. Delta did not give an updated full-year outlook as they continue to monitor the future of the tariffs and market instability. The plan is to give an update later as the year plays out. For NPR News, I'm Marlon Hyde in Atlanta.
Microsoft says it is slowing or pausing some data center construction, including a $1 billion project in Ohio. It's the latest sign AI demand may be a little less than tech firms had expected. Microsoft confirms it's halting early-stage work at a site outside Columbus, Ohio. Some analysts say Microsoft's changed relationship with ChatGPT maker OpenAI may also be to blame. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. When a man in Michigan was heading home on Sunday from a family vacation in the Caribbean, he was stopped in the Detroit airport. Federal officers, border agents detained him, interrogated him, and pressured him to hand over his cell phone. The man is a U.S. citizen. He's a civil rights and criminal defense attorney, and among his clients is an activist who has been charged in connection to a pro-Palestinian protest at the University of Michigan. That attorney's name is Amir Makled, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. Okay, so as I understand, you were returning home from vacation with your family. Then you were pulled aside by some federal agents. Pick up the story from there and just start to tell us what happened.
Well, as soon as I got to the passport check line, the agent looked over to another agent and asked, is the TTRT team available? I didn't know what that acronym stood for, so right. I did a quick Google search. At that point, I realized it meant the Task Force on Terrorism, something along those lines. Tactical Terrorism Response Team is what the acronym was. And at that point, my gut just, you know, my heart fell into my stomach at that point. I was so, you know, concerned and worried. I looked over at my wife and I told her we're probably gonna be stopped and detained and questioned. And so, they eventually took me over to an interview room. My family was waiting for me anxiously, not knowing what was going on. And then a plainclothes officer walks in and says, we know that you're an attorney, and we know that you've been handling some high-profile cases lately. And then I said, okay, well, what can I help you with? And he said, we would like to look at your phone. And he handed me a pamphlet with a federal statute that says that at the border, they're allowed to confiscate my phone for a number of days. And at that point, I was just shocked that they wanted to take my phone.
Well, let me ask you this. At that point, did you have any sense of why they wanted to see your phone? What did they tell you?
Well, it was apparent to me at that point that they had already done their homework about me before I arrived, because they knew that I was taking on some cases. He knew who I was, and he knew where I was coming from, and he knew I was an attorney. So it wasn't a random selection. They were prepared to talk to me and discuss things with me. And he was adamant that he wanted to see my phone.
What did you do then? Did you give him your phone?
No. At that point, I said, listen, you know that I'm an attorney. Everything in my phone could be privileged information. I have emails that go back over 10 years. I have text messages with clients. I have all my court filings and my office filings are in my cloud, which is available on my phone. Mm-hmm. You're not getting full and unfettered access to my device. It's not going to happen. And so that puzzled this agent, and he had to go to a supervisor. The supervisor comes back and says, here's a legal pad. Here's a pen. Write down everything that you believe is privileged. We won't go through that. I looked at him with, you know, astonishment. How do you expect me to go through 10 years and more of information that's in my device and see this is privileged and this isn't? It was a ridiculous conversation.
You said in other interviews that I've heard that you believe that you were targeted because you were representing a pro-Palestinian protester. You said that they seemed to know who you were. They seemed to know that you were an attorney. What led you to make the connection that this protester might have been the reason that you were detained, interrogated, they wanted your phone?
This is the only case of any high-profile action that I'm involved in right now. This is the only one that we've been making a lot of noise about because in Samantha Lewis's case, my client at the University of Michigan, they're criminalizing free speech. They're charging seven students with resisting and opposing police officers, which are felonies. And all they were doing was engaging in peaceful protest about the war in on Gaza. So that we've made a lot of noise about and that we're vigorously defending. Why else would they mention that I know that you're engaging in high-profile cases?
I just want to note that NPR has reached out to Customs and Border Protection, and at the time of our conversation, we've not yet heard back. But a CBP spokesman named Hilton Beckham told the Detroit Free Press, which you spoke to, that searches of electronic media have not gone up during the Trump administration. And I'm going to quote here, allegations that political beliefs trigger inspections or removals are baseless and irresponsible. Your response?
I'd say to them that, you know, what was the purpose of searching my device then? If you know that I'm not there's no probable cause, there's no warrant, there's no concern that I'm a threat to national security or anything of that nature. The purpose of searching my phone doesn't have anything to do with terrorism. There's only a chilling effect, and it's done to be intimidating, in my opinion, for the causes that I was engaging in. I'm standing up for students. I'm standing up for immigrants and political dissenters. And I think this was a way to try to dissuade me from taking on these types of cases.
Ultimately, you did not consent to just hand over your phone. But if I understand correctly, you did at some point let them look at the contacts that are in your phone. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, they kept threatening to take my device, and they said they had the legal right to do so. So I didn't want to walk away from that meeting or interrogation or detention without my device in my hand. So I did acquiesce to allowing them to see the list of my contacts that's stored in my phone only. And they agreed with that. They said, okay, we'll look at your contact list, and we'll go from there. So at that point, they took my device for maybe 7 or 8 minutes, and they came back. They apparently had downloaded my contact list, and then began to ask me further questions about who contacts in my phone were. Mm. And that's when I said, no, this is getting into too much uncharted waters here. Anybody that's in my phone is going to be a friend, a family member, or a client.
Right.
I'm not going to tell you if these folks are clients or not, but that's all the information you're going to get.
Okay. If this is part of a much broader effort to intimidate lawyers whose work runs counter to administration priorities, I want to ask you in the minute or so that we have left, is this working?
No, I think it's doing the opposite effect. The outpouring support that I've received from members of the bar, not just in Michigan, but nationally, and members of the community, is a showing that people are offended by this type of conduct. This is not what America's all about. We are a nation of laws. We have protections. We have amendments, the Fourth Amendment included, of your right to privacy, which includes not having your personal effects and papers be searched. It's setting a terrifying precedent. If government agents can target a lawyer at the border, what's stopping them from doing it to anyone who dares to speak out?
We've been speaking with Michigan attorney Amir Macled. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Can you recite the names of all the planets in our solar system? Well, ever since Pluto got demoted, schools today have kids memorizing 8 major planets. But some astronomers suspect that at the edge of our solar system, there is another large planet, and they call it Planet 9. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports that astronomers have been hunting for Planet 9 for almost a decade, and they're about to get their best chance to find it.
Mike Brown is convinced that far beyond Neptune, there's a planet that no one has discovered. And he says it's not some little world that's debatably a planet like Pluto. He says this thing is bigger than Earth.
This is the fifth largest planet in our solar system lurking out there waiting to be found.
Brown is an astronomer at Caltech. He says the evidence for this planet comes from a small number of Pluto-like dwarf planets in the outer solar system. Their orbits are unexpectedly weird in various ways, and he says no one has come up with an explanation, other than that they are being influenced by a much larger, unseen planet that's exerting a gravitational pull.
I just don't see a way that the solar system can exist the way it does without there being a Planet 9, so I am extraordinarily confident that this thing is really out there.
But it's so far away, Planet Nine would be really faint, and researchers haven't been able to narrow down where in the sky to search. Enter the Vera Rubin Observatory. For years, it's been under construction on a mountaintop in Chile, and it's now on the verge of starting up, with the final tweaking of its instruments slated to begin this month. This is a powerful facility that's designed to scan basically the entire southern sky every few days. Bob Blum is director of operations.
We will cover a huge area of the sky, and we will go very deep because the telescope itself is a big telescope, so it can see really faint objects.
A huge digital camera the size of a car will take images of whatever the telescope sees, and computer systems will be constantly comparing new images with the ones taken previously. That means this observatory will detect anything that changes, like, say, Planet Nine moving across the sky.
If it's there, we should be able to find it pretty easily.
One scientist who's long been looking for evidence of Planet Nine is Scott Shepard with Carnegie Science. He says this new telescope is a game changer.
Vera Rubin is our best bet to find it in the next few years, probably. It's got to turn over more rocks than anyone has turned over before.
He says if the planet is real, this observatory has like a 70-80% chance of finding it. There are so many uncertainties.
We don't know the size of the planet. We don't know its reflectivity of the planet. We don't know the distance of the planet. Those three things will determine how bright this planet actually is.
Shepard says if Planet Nine is on the small side, dark and really far away,
it's got to be on the edge of Vera Rubin detection, and Vera Rubin may not find it.
But the Rubin Observatory might find more minor planets, ones whose orbits might be affected by Planet Nine, and that could provide more evidence that such a planet really exists out there. Shepard says he personally isn't convinced one way or another.
The statistics just aren't there to definitively say yes or no.
He thinks a major planet is one of the most exciting things this new observatory could discover.
Planets are cool, right? I mean, there's you find one a century. You consider Pluto a planet. We found one last century.
So he says maybe it's about time to find another. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you. Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The new Max drama, The Pitt, has been lauded for being one of the only medical shows to get it right. And The It is the nitty-gritty of medicine itself and what it is like to work in a big city emergency room. There is another thing The Pitt is getting praised for getting right as well, and that is the portrayal of a neurodivergent character, second-year resident Dr. Mel King.
As you can see, we have some new faces with us this morning. Good morning, good morning. Come on over. Starting with second-year resident Dr. Melissa King, fresh from the VA.
Everyone calls me Mel. I'm so happy to be here.
Mel is portrayed by actress Taylor Dearden, who joins me now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, you've seen this in all of the reviews of the show, and I have seen this in conversation with multiple doctors I know, including doctors who work in ERs. They've said this show kind of, obviously it's a show and it's dramatized a little bit, but it gets it in an accurate way more than any other show. What is it about the approach that you all took that you think nailed it so well?
Well, we had 2 weeks of medical boot camp before we started shooting, which was incredibly helpful. And all trauma scenes are directed by doctors instead of the director. It serves the medicine is the whole goal. And I remember at the very beginning, John Wells told us that if we are unsure about something, instead of going to the director, if it's medical, just always listen to the doctor. Even if the director wants something else, like always listen to the doctors.
And the directors were okay with that?
They don't know that happened.
Yes. You know, Mel is, we heard that early on clip. This is a room filled with burned out, cynical, frustrated people. And that is not her. She is not a cynical person. She is a joyous person. She's a positive person. What do you think it is that she finds so rewarding about an incredibly hard job?
I think that it's incredibly hard and that Mel can do it. Recognizing that something's hard for anyone and then being able to overcome it if you are neurodivergent, like, hopefully that should just make it even sweeter.
Can we talk about the thing I mentioned in the introduction, and you mentioned it as well? You know, Mel is often at times a little awkward in a very charming way, and in likable way, and it seems like sarcasm is a tricky dynamic for her to pick up, among other things, and she's been talked about in reviews and online chatter as being described as having autistic coded behaviors, which my understanding is she's not, but I've heard you say in interviews that she has ADHD. What should we know, and what do you think about?
I don't know what Mel's diagnosis is. I have ADHD.
Yeah.
So I think I've just been letting some of the things that I am better at masking, I'm just letting the mask come down a little bit more. I have a few friends whose siblings are more need autism, and because of that, they never noticed that their younger child, my friends, are also autistic. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, trying to show that it really is a spectrum. And also that, you know, ADHD has finally been put on the same spectrum as autism.
I think a lot of people have somebody in their family or somebody in their life who does have ADHD and see all the different ways it could play out. It was interesting you said that there's behavior that you sometimes mask that you don't mask in the scenes. Can you give us one example maybe from one scene where you kind of consciously thought about that or just played out that way on camera?
I think a lot of my anxiety I'm able to mask better. And I just kind of liked the idea that Mel can't mask much of anything, mm-hmm. especially because of how sweet she is. It's just, you know, you get all Mel all the time.
You okay?
I get frustrated when I can't do things, or at least it looks like it.
Yeah, you and me both.
Thanks, but my frustration manifests itself emotionally, and then I get upset, and then it looks like I can't handle things, and, you know, then I can't cry in front of the patient because no one wants to see their doctor cry. That's just a big red flag.
You just hit a perfect crack. You're doing great.
I think there have been a few scenes of just, like, recovery too. There's a scene where Mel is looking at a lava lamp app. We're listening to the ocean sound. Mm-hmm. And it's all of the self-soothing and stimming that is, which I'm really glad they show that part, because they don't usually show that.
Is there anything that you personally in real life learned from this experience, whether it was that medical boot camp or the front end or where the show was approached or filmed?
This is it's a very tough show for neurodivergence to be in.
Yeah.
It moves really fast. It's really hard words. It's actions we just learned. You have to put all of that together at the same time and as quickly as possible. And we go so quickly, we don't have much time to take a second to review, to calm down. Mm-hmm. And so it's definitely a challenge to shoot.
Can I ask, you're talking about the importance of showing that recovery time for Mel, the character. Is that something you were trying to make sure to get for yourself as an actor on set in this environment that seemed just as overwhelming as it really are?
Yeah, and it's tough to find the time. It's also very tough to explain to people what's going on inside. If it's not, you can't see that I'm panic-stricken. It's kind of hard to understand that I am. I eventually had to get some earplugs that just soften external noise so that you could at least try and hear better of just what's in front of you. And I started wearing those, which I definitely pitched like, yeah, I think Mel should wear these, which is just so that I can wear them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that have to happen for it to be, I don't know, comfortable to explore.
You're talking about your experience on the set, portraying a neurodivergent character as somebody who's neurodivergent yourself, and you're talking about kind of the challenges that creates. But it seems like you've also made a decision to be okay and open talking about it to the press, talking about it in public in a way that I think a lot of people would shy away from doing. Was that an active decision on your end? Why do you think that's important to be honest about?
It was. When I talked to Scott and John early on in the med boot camp that we had, I told them that I relate to this character because I see a lot of the neurodivergent parts of Mel as something I experience all the time. And John said something that was just like, I didn't even think about it. And he was just so wonderful. He said, do you want to come out of the neurotypical neurodivergence closet, so to speak, for the show? Are you willing to do that? And I had never thought of, oh yeah, that is something you have to think of. And I took it home, I thought it over, and I realized it's like, you know, I can mask only so much, and I'm really ready for people to know. I tell everyone I meet, because there are certain social behaviors that might seem odd, and so I usually have to tell everyone I meet, like, in case I do this, just so you know, it's not on purpose. So it was great for them to let it be my decision completely. I feel like it's the right move.
That is actress Taylor Dearden. She plays Dr. Mel King on Max's The Pitt. You can catch the season finale tomorrow night. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR's Morning Edition, which reminds you of the power of one human voice. You turn on the radio some morning, or your device, and you're listening to Morning Edition, and you hear one person telling a story from the other side of the world or from a neighborhood near you, and that voice brings you understanding of the news. Listen to Morning Edition every day.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald is turning 100. How is the novel being taught today, and how are students responding?
You get to the end, and it all of a sudden goes from like a level 10 to 100. It's like, oh my gosh, they just like ran over a person.
That's a spoiler coming up after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services will begin screening immigrant social media accounts for anti-Semitic activity. NPR's Jasmine Gars tells us they're looking for grounds to deny immigration requests.
The screenings may affect people applying for permanent residence status and foreigners affiliated with educational institutions. The Department of Homeland Security, in a statement, said it will, quote, protect the homeland from extremists and terrorist aliens, including those who support anti-Semitic terrorism. The announcement comes following the detention of pro-Palestinian student activists like Mahmoud Khalil, who's been held for a month. Advocates say it's an attack on free speech. Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem recently posted on X, quote, "It is a privilege to be granted a visa to live and study in the United States of America. When you advocate for violence and terrorism, that privilege should be revoked." Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
In Pittsburgh, federal workers rallied today against the Trump administration's efforts to downsize the federal workforce from member station WESA. Kate Giamarisi reports.
Workers from the Veterans Affairs Administration, the IRS, and other agencies rallied outside of the Moorhead Federal Building in downtown Pittsburgh. Elizabeth McPeak is an IRS employee and first vice president of the National Treasury Employees Union, Chapter 34. She says she and her colleagues provide crucial services to taxpayers.
We have 300 people in this building right behind me who are taking a million taxpayer calls every single day. If those people aren't there, those calls aren't going to get answered.
McPeak and others at the rally also oppose a recent Trump administration executive order to limit the collective bargaining rights of many federal workers.
This is NPR. Some Egyptologists are hoping a trip to the Great Pyramids by the world's most popular YouTube star will spur more interest in archaeology. NPR's Netta Ulaby has the story.
Mr. Beast, otherwise known as Jimmy Donaldson, got massive on social media for his wild stunts. This one came with help from the Egyptian government.
I somehow have unrestricted access to all the Great Pyramids of Egypt!
Egyptian archaeologists said that access was actually restricted. But the videos Mr. Beast put on TikTok and YouTube have gotten hundreds of millions of views.
Whoa.
The influencer oohs and ahs over ancient murals and architecture. This attention from someone with nearly 400 million followers, more than anyone else on YouTube, may help a country hoping to boost tourism with its new Grand Egyptian Museum opening this summer. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Universal Studios has chosen a site near London to build its first European theme park. The entertainment company plans to break ground next year in Bedford, the home of Harry Potter, just outside of London, on the outskirts there. Britain's prime minister says the Universal theme park will create thousands of jobs and bring joy to Britain. The theme park and resort is expected to open sometime in 2031. Stock surged on Wall Street today in a sign of relief after President Trump paused most of his tariffs. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. President Trump's big new tariffs had just come into effect today, but after a little more than 12 hours, he announced that he would pause most of them for 90 days. Since the president first laid out his plans, markets have been on a wild ride for the past week. NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson joins us now. Hi there.
Hi there.
I mean, Mara, this was quite the plot twist. How did the president explain it?
Well, this was pretty extraordinary. First, the White House spent most of the day saying it was all part of the plan. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent told reporters this pause had nothing to do with the markets tanking. But then when President Trump was asked about it, he gave a different explanation for the pause. Here's what he said.
Well, I thought that people were jumping a little bit out of line. They were getting yippy, you know, they were getting a little bit yippy, a little bit afraid.
So it sounds like the market turmoil was the reason Trump made the pause. The announcement came during trading hours, and the markets did make up for some of its recent losses, but there were no details available right away, so it was very, very haphazard and confusing.
Indeed. So what do we know about what happens next?
What happens next is there's still an across-the-board tariff of 10% on imports coming into the U.S. for all countries. But in the case of China, Trump has raised the tariffs to a total of 125% because China retaliated against his original tariffs. For all the other countries that were supposed to have reciprocal tariffs put on, there's going to now be a series of negotiations instead during the next 90 days. And it's still not exactly clear what the White House is looking for in those talks. Maybe concessions, even small ones that he can call victories so he gets an off-ramp to climb down from an all-out trade war. Or maybe he's trying to eliminate the trade imbalances with all the countries in the world. We don't know because he's never been clear about what the purpose of the tariffs were. To bring in lots of money, to balance the budget and pay for tax cuts, or to get rid of trade deficits that he has described as a threat to America's way of life.
I mean, Mara, you've been doing this for a long time and you've covered Trump for a long time. How surprised were you at this turn of events?
Not that surprised. Trump has a pattern of making big threats and then backing down. We saw that earlier in the year with Mexico and Canada. But this time, the White House said he had the stomach to push through the turmoil. They were adamant there would be no pause. Trump recently posted, quote, "My policies will never change." And then they did. So people who thought these tariffs were a negotiating tactic, it looks like they were right, at least for the moment.
Tell me what else stood out to you from today's announcements.
What else stood out to me is that the incredible effort, the great lengths that Trump and his top officials went to argue that this wasn't a back down or a reversal. Bessent said this was his strategy all along. He said the president had great courage to hold the line, to stay the course until this moment. But it was only 12 hours until he backed off, right, since the tariffs went on. And Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick said that Trump wrote one of the most extraordinary truth posts of his presidency. So it sounds like they're really trying to refute the comments and views of all those economists and Wall Street traders and billionaires that there didn't seem to be a clear or rational strategy to what Trump was doing with these tariffs. Last night, in a dinner with lots of Republicans, the president said, quote, "I know what the hell I'm doing." So it sounds like they really wanted to dispel this idea that he didn't know what he was doing. And also, the other thing that struck me is that even for Trump, who expects constant and lavish praise from his cabinet secretaries, today was pretty much over the top.
NPR's Mara Liasson, thank you.
Thank you.
Almost immediately after the fall of dictator Bashar al-Assad, Syria came under attack. Israel has struck Syria several hundred times since December, and until recently, Syria's new government stayed quiet. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from one village that was hit.
Abdulrahman Hamdan walks through his family's olive grove, recounting how his uncle called him from here in a panic last month. Israeli troops had crossed into Syria when Assad fell. At the time, Syria's new government was just forming. It didn't have the means to counter Israel and said it wanted cordial relations. But Israeli troops were now moving deeper into Syria. They were bombing infrastructure and seizing land in Hamdan's village. His uncle told him he and his neighbors were rushing out with hunting rifles after Israeli troops killed two farmers. The villagers fired first at Israeli troops on their property. The response, he says, was disproportionate. Israeli helicopters, drones, artillery. Hamdan shows me the call log on his phone.
9:15.
In the morning.
He died 9:30. He was killed 9:30.
His uncle was one of seven people killed by Israeli troops who entered their village that day. The Israeli military called them terrorists. People like Aza Mohammed, a mother of six, who lost her leg to an Israeli artillery strike. She lays on a bed, bandaged and helpless, in the house of her father, Hani Mohammed, who says some in Syria are downplaying these attacks out of fear. Some of the older folks used to go to school just west of here in the Golan Heights before Israel seized that territory in 1967 and still occupies it today. Israel used to attack Iranian weapons being funneled through Syria to Hezbollah in neighboring Lebanon. But those routes were cut off with Assad's ouster. Since then, Syria has arrested Hezbollah militants, and zero attacks on Israel have originated here. But Israel has launched several hundred air and artillery strikes like these, saying it wants to prevent the formation of any threat. A farmer named Mossab El Abdullah zips up on his motorbike out of breath. He's just run from Israeli soldiers. He says this is the second time they've come onto his farm in jeeps. Last month, he was harvesting zucchini when they took him and seven other farmers at gunpoint, he says, into Israel for questioning. Then dropped him back off with a warning to stay off their own land. The Israeli military confirmed his account, calling his farm a closed military zone now.
We reported to the UN.
One possible recourse for Abdullah is United Nations peacekeepers stationed nearby.
Okay, we're at the door of this UN base. No entry, authorized personnel only.
A UN peacekeeper answers the big blue metal door topped with barbed wire.
Hi.
She asks me to stop recording.
Please, can you stop recording?
And okay. Speaks to Abdullah through a grate. But it's difficult. She doesn't speak Arabic. She doesn't ask for his name. She says she'll make a report. He offers his phone number, but he never got a call back the last time he did this either. NPR asked the UN for an update on his case. It replied that it continues to engage with the Israeli military about what it calls its violations in this area. As Abdullah walks away, he says he feels really let down. He's scared to go back to his farm, but if he can't harvest his land, he'll go hungry, he says. A day later, dozens of Israeli military vehicles entered Syria again near here. Afterwards, Syria's new government found its voice. It called these attacks a, quote, clear Israeli attempt to normalize violence, undermining Syria's efforts to rebuild after 14 years of civil war. Lauren Freyer, NPR News in Daraa, southern Syria.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Global markets surged as President Trump announced a 90-day pause on worldwide tariffs, with the exception of China. But this news came just hours after the EU voted to impose tariffs on specific U.S. products sold in Europe. That was in response to American tariffs on European aluminum and steel. It's a sequence of events that has added to the confusion of many Europeans. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports from Paris.
French news channels could hardly keep up today. Just as the EU voted to apply tariffs, President Trump hit pause again. Emmanuel Lechypre, an economic correspondent with BFM French TV, called Trump's abrupt turnabout spectacular.
We always have this unpredictability with Donald Trump that has become almost structural. He pushes buttons, launches provocations. He's always in this position of permanent surprises.
The EU's carefully considered list will be released next week, but has been widely leaked. It includes products like wood, poultry, fruit, and even dental floss. What was not on the list was U.S. bourbon. President Trump had promised a 200% counter-tariff on European wine and spirits if it was. The U.S. is Europe's top wine, champagne, and spirits market, so France, Italy, and Ireland banded together to make sure that didn't happen. Europe does not want a trade war. It is rolling out its response slowly to give negotiations a chance. Some tariffs on its list would not even take effect until next December, and the EU is offering zero tariffs if the U.S. reciprocates. But it is a huge market with 450 million consumers and is not ready to roll over, said French President Emmanuel Macron.
La France, l'Europe n'ont jamais souhaité le chaos.
France and Europe never wanted this chaos or the tariffs, but we will respond to protect our industries, he said. 28-year-old Léa Desmoutes was enjoying a glass of wine at a sidewalk cafe on a balmy Paris night. She says it's hard to understand what Trump wants.
C'est catastrophique.
It's catastrophic. It's against free market values and globalization to close off your country like this. It goes against our system of living together.
Her friend Anne Audriard agrees.
C'est un bazar incroyable. Moi, j'arrive pas trop bien à suivre ce qui
se passe. It's bedlam. I can't even follow it anymore, she says. Between what your president is doing and our response to it, it's a morass. I think we need to wait a little and see. European leaders are also dealing with what many feel is Trump's unpredictability in other areas. For example, will the U.S. stay in NATO and still support Ukraine? Add to that the gyrating markets.
Bonjour, monsieur.
Parisian Arthur Le Gallou works in a wine shop, but he says what's going on is bigger than wine. Trump's actions are hurting the world, he says, but they're especially hurting America.
It's a great nation. It's a big nation of human rights, of democracy, and it's bad sign. I think it's bad for America and for all the world, yeah.
This wine seller says it feels like President Trump is using his country like a company to make money for the rich. But for the rest of the world, he says, he's making chaos and uncertainty. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Okay, imagine you are an NBA coach and you're going in for a performance review and you're feeling pretty good, right? Because your team just won the championship 2 years ago and your star player has won 3 of the last 4 MVP awards. And so you walk into your boss's office and guess what happens? You get fired. That is what happened to Mike Malone, the coach of the Denver Nuggets this week. His boss, the general manager, was also fired. And the move sent shockwaves across the NBA. But Malone is far from alone. Of the past 5 coaches to win an NBA title, only 2 still have their jobs. So, what does it take to hold on to your coaching job in the NBA? Well, to help us answer that question is Mike Vorkunov of The Athletic. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So help us understand what is going on here. Like, why would a coach who has seen this much success lose his job? Please make this clear.
I wish I could tell you that it was an easy case of something, but it's not. It's a little bit complicated. You know, to your point, he did win an NBA title less than 2 years ago. Now he is out of a job. Part of it is that arguably the Denver Nuggets had been on a bit of a skid lately. You know, with the NBA and the Western Conference, it's a very tightly packed situation there. And so they're a little bit on the precipice with only 3 games to go in the regular season. And additionally, as you mentioned, the general manager was also fired and there had been a bit of a schism in the organization between the head coach and the general manager that seemed to have helped contribute to the many factors that led to Mike Malone losing his job. But still, the timing of it.
Yes, the timing of it is weird. What does it take to hold on to your coaching job in the NBA? Like, why wouldn't winning a championship give you some job security?
Maybe it's too simple to say that only winning more championships can help you keep your job.
Do you think these firings of coaches reflect something bigger going on in the NBA right now?
It does seem to show that there's less job security now for even, you know, title winning coaches. You know, 3 of the last 5 coaches to win an NBA title have not only been fired, but fired within 2 years of winning a championship. It seems like really, you know, the only coaches in the NBA that have this supreme kind of job security are Steve Kerr, Eric Spoelstra, and Greg Popovich, and everyone else is already on the clock almost as soon as the parade is over and the confetti's being picked up. And so everything does seem a little bit more pressurized in the NBA these days.
Well, I am also wondering, you know, because teams in the NBA are getting more and more valuable. And is that trend with coaches related to that? Like the billionaires who have purchased these teams, they want their teams to win now. They want a return on investment now. Is that also part of what's going on?
Yeah, I think that could partly be part of the trend. I think it's hard to sometimes marry the two things. You know, in this case, and also another head coach, Taylor Jenkins, was fired from the Memphis Grizzlies with about 10 games to go, even though the team was set to make the playoffs. The ownership groups for those two teams are not new. They've been owning teams for a while. But I think it is fair to say that as teams become more valuable, as there is more money being spent on player salary, as everything is being more professionalized, there does seem to be a bit more of an expectation of results and less of a grace period for people who don't get them.
Okay. That is Mike Vorkunov of The Athletic. Thank you so much for coming on to our show.
Happy to do it.
There's a pretty good chance that you read or will read F. Scott Fitzgerald's classic novel, The Great Gatsby, in high school. I mean, I certainly did. And it remains a staple of high school English reading lists across the country. The book turns 100 tomorrow, so we were wondering, what is it like experiencing the book in a classroom setting now? Here's NPR's Andrew Limbong.
Even if you did read it in high school, you probably didn't have a lesson like the one Brian Hannon is teaching.
All right, phones, put them up.
He teaches AP English Literature at Hayfield Secondary School in Virginia, and after collecting all the kids' phones, he goes into a lesson comparing themes and motifs in The Great Gatsby to Parasite, the Bong Joon-ho movie from 2019 that also deals with class differences.
Like, what is something from Parasite that could effectively work as something similar to Daisy?
Daisy, if you don't remember, is the object of Jay Gatsby's affection, representing an upper crust social strata. Hannon shows his students a report from the Obama White House showing wealth inequality in the U.S.
There's actually a term for that. The term for the inability to move from one social class to the next is called the Great Gatsby Curve. Okay, and here's kind of a quick chart, but
But when I chatted with some of the students, it wasn't necessarily econ policy that got them excited. Grace Verghese thought the book took its time setting up various romances and relationships, but it paid off.
And then you get to the end and it all of a sudden goes from like a level 10 to 100. It's like, oh my gosh, they just like ran over a person.
By the way, you're not allowed to be mad at me for spoiling The Great Gatsby. This is literally a piece about how it's 100 years old. Anyway.
And they don't care at all. And then Gatsby gets shot dead in the pool and Daisy does not care. And so it was kind of just like, okay, like I'm dozing off. Then all of a sudden you're just wide awake again with everything that's happening in the book.
They are far more interested in the romance and the tea of the novel. You know,
Amy Goldman teaches AP language at River City High School in West Sacramento, California, and has been teaching the book for 2 decades. And in those years, she hasn't seen much change from the student reaction side. What is different is fewer and fewer of her colleagues are teaching the book in favor of books by women or people of color. But Goldman says Gatsby still has a lot to teach kids about the craft of writing, that the book is unique in its structure and syntax.
It's only 180 pages. It's very short. And each chapter is organized in a very specific way. And I think it's important for them to see that authors can do things, and then also to see how we can interpret those.
Well, at least, you know, he made it out, though. That's the difference.
Speaking of interpreting, back at Hayfield, class is over. Some students make their way out the door, others linger by teacher Brian Hannon's desk, including Hamza Nadiri, who makes the point that, hey, no matter how the book ended, at least Gatsby achieved a pretty comfortable life.
I'm just saying, it's nice, like, not having to go to the coal mines. You can just, like, wake up and just thinking about, like, damn. Yeah, my biggest problem.
Another student, Iris Nabruk, chimes in.
I think you're totally wrong because the whole point is that he's trying to get Daisy. Like, okay.
Again, class is over. This isn't for participation points. These are just teenagers chatting.
Like, I hate that he doesn't care at all about the fact that he has wealth, and I feel like he should care so much more about the fact that he
has
wealth.
That's what I'm trying to. Right. A lot of the things that we're saying is the same.
In its 100 years, The Great Gatsby has inspired a lot of things. A few movies, a musical, cruises, parties, vacation packages. But it's also spent 100 years inspiring discussions like this one. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
To All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice. At